I think it's important for people to know that the rule of law is back, that no one is above the law. You can't simply refuse to appear when you're subpoenaed before Congress, before a court. It shouldn't matter whether you're the man on the street or you're a pal of the former president. So the rule of law is back. Steve Bannon has very important information that we want to hear. He was predicting on January 5th, the day before the bloody insurrection, that all hell was going to break loose. He was telling people that if they were bemoaning the fact they weren't around during the American Revolution, that here was another opportunity to be part of revolution. So we're going to pursue it vigorously.
Since Bannon may never testify, is this more about sending a message to other potential witnesses?
Oh, I think he'll testify or he'll go to jail, and he can be sentenced to jail for up to a year. But it's also important, as you point out, to others who may think that because of the last 4 years when people like Bill Barr were attorney general and essentially protected Donald Trump by refusing to go after those who lied to cover up for him. In fact, Bill Barr intervened to reduce the sentence of one such liar, Roger Stone, and make the case go away as to another, Michael Flynn. Those days are over. We now have an attorney general who's devoted to the rule of law. And I think that it will send an important message to others that unless they too wish to face prosecution, they need to fulfill their obligations as citizens.
This kind of thing with Bannon hasn't been done since the Watergate era. What do you say to the argument that this panel is an extension of what the former president has called the witch hunt?
Well, you know, it's fitting that after Watergate, this remedy was also used because there it was also important to investigate the abuses of the Nixon administration. And we haven't had a president since Nixon to engage in the kind of wholesale abuse of office. You know, to those who listen to the president say it's a witch hunt, he says that about everything. He's still pushing the big lie about our election, which is a patent falsehood. The facts are what they are, and we were attacked on January 6th. We were attacked by the president's own supporters. It was a bloody assault on the seat of our democracy. We are determined to get out the full facts of what went into that day and overcome any opposition. And that's what we're going to do because the safety of the country requires it.
Chairman Schiff, you've touched on this already just a little bit. What does Bannon know that you want to know?
Well, I think he can shed a lot of light on the run-up to January 6th. What did he know about the propensity for violence that day? What did he know about the participation of white nationalist groups? What did the president know? What was the president's plan for January 6th if Mike Pence refused, as he did, to ignore the will of the popular vote and refuse to count the electors from particular states? What was the plan? Was violence always the plan? The biggest black box, frankly, is what was the president doing? What did he know? When did he know it? And obviously, Bannon is in a position to shed light.
You're well aware of the Capitol Police whistleblower who accuses a couple of senior leaders of mishandling intelligence surrounding the riot. We understand that that person wants to testify, but at last report had not heard from your panel. Would you like to speak to this whistleblower?
You know, I think anyone who has relevant information about failures of intelligence, failures to collect it, failures to share it, that we're going to want to hear from. And I can't speak for the committee. It will be a judgment that the chairman makes in terms of any specific witness. But we are examining that very bucket of issues. So that is, there was a lot out there on social media, a lot of planning that went on, a lot of red flags going up. And what was disseminated was very small in terms of the universe of available intelligence. So we want to flesh out that full story, and we'll be interested, I think, and anyone that has relevant information.
Here in the Washington area, we're paying close attention to your colleague, Jamie Raskin of Maryland, on this panel as well, and someone you worked with closely in the impeachment proceedings. In the same vein as I was asking about how you spend your time on the January 6th committee, was impeachment worth it in terms of Democratic wins on the board, showing the American people how you plan to help them, and perhaps not giving ammunition to Donald Trump's forces?
I think the impeachments were enormously important in two respects. First, we did our constitutional duty. Had we not done our constitutional duty, then people would assume that these kind of actions, withholding hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to an ally at war to get them to help you cheat in an election, or even worse, inciting an insurrection, against our own government, that somehow that this is compatible with the presidency. So the failure to do our duty, I think, would have sent exactly the wrong message to future presidents who might abuse their power. But also, I think that we fleshed out for the country the evidence of the president's gross misconduct, his terrible abuse of power. And I would like to believe, in terms of the first impeachment, which took place before the election, that it helped educate the American people about why it would be such a danger to return him to office. And in fact, they would make the decision they would not return him to office.
We all have regrets, and among yours, you include a parody of Donald Trump's phone call with Ukraine's president in that first impeachment. Looking back on it now, why did you launch into that?
Oh, I was trying to mock the president, because when I read it, it was such a shakedown that I was familiar with as a former prosecutor, such an organized shakedown of a leader of another country to coerce him into helping the president cheat. But you're right, it was not necessary, and it gave the president fodder to attack me and create a whole false narrative about the hearing. But frankly, and I discuss this in the book too, what disturbed me more about that hearing was the fact that I was too slow to pivot to what was in the whistleblower complaint. We got the complaint just the night before, and we were very focused on how the former director of intelligence had violated the law by withholding the complaint. The whole purpose of the hearing was to compel him to give the complaint to us and the American people. That it was, you know, halfway into the hearing when I made the switch to actually focus on the allegations. And that was what I was mad at myself about after the hearing, and I felt I'd left the caucus down. It wasn't really until later that the president chose to continue to try to make an issue of my mocking him, that became a thing.
So let's further dive into your book. Is the window to save democracy closing? Is that really at the heart of what you're writing about?
It's not closing. And I titled the book Midnight in Washington in part because it was the title of a closing argument I gave during the trial, but also because midnight is the darkest hour of every day, but it's also a hopeful time because it's filled with the promise of light. We're at a very dangerous point. There's no doubt about it. The efforts around the country to strip independent elections officials of their duties and give them over to partisan boards and partisan legislatures is an effort to overturn the next election where they failed before. And that is among the gravest risks that we face. But I'm optimistic because I know there are millions and millions more Americans who love this democracy, who love our legacy, than those who wish to tear it down. At the moment, the Republican Party has turned itself into a cult around the former president. It's not a party of ideas or ideology. As long as that's the case, they're just going to have to be beaten at the polls. But, you know, this is a tough time. I'm confident we're going to get through it. And what we do right now will determine how quickly we get through it. And I think there's a role for every American to help us get through this.
Looking at an anecdote here, we thought 2010 was still a relatively normal time, but in that year, I understand you shared a flight with Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader. Tell that story that you write about in the book and what it may mean for us now.
Well, I tell this story because the most common question I get from people is, do the Republicans really believe what they're saying when you talk to them in private? And so I tell the story about being on a plane with Kevin McCarthy. This was in 2010. When the midterms were about 6 months away. And we were having kind of a nothing of a conversation. We were just waiting for the movie to begin, at least I was. I said that I thought Democrats would win the midterms, and not surprisingly, he said that he thought Republicans were going to win the midterms. And I didn't think anything of it. The plane landed, we went our separate ways. But apparently McCarthy went off to do a briefing for the press. And he told the press that I sat next to Adam Schiff on United Airlines. And he confirmed that Republicans were going to win the midterms. Everybody knows it. And I didn't find out about this until the following morning. And I was just in disbelief that he would so brazenly lie about our conversation. And I went up to him on the House floor and I said, Kevin, if we're having a private conversation on the plane, I would have thought it was a private conversation. But if it wasn't, you know, I said the exact opposite of what you told the press. And he looks at me and he says, yeah, I know, Adam, but you know how it goes. And I said, no, Kevin, I don't know how it goes. You just make stuff up and that's how you operate because That's not how I operate. But that is how he operates. That's how all too many of my colleagues right now in the GOP operate. And in that sense, Kevin McCarthy was really made for a moment like this, when the former president and the leader of his party has no compunction about falsehood after falsehood. He will say anything, do anything to gain power or keep it. And in the case of Kevin McCarthy, we just can't let someone like that go anywhere near the Speaker's office.
So issues are much too serious for our country to engage in much gossip. But I just wonder, you've certainly had to speak with McCarthy many times in the decade plus since that interaction. Do you talk to him much? Do you keep your conversations very short and businesslike?
I would say that our conversations have been civil in person. I don't know how Steny Hoyer, who has to interact with him the most, majority leader, I don't know how he does it. Because if you can't rely on someone that you're working with to be truthful or to keep a commitment, I don't know how you work with them. But I will say this, you know, Devin Nunes and I have had no share of vigorous disagreements. And yet every year, he and I have produced an Intelligence Authorization Act, which is the product of a year's worth of oversight. We have been, you know, without ever needing to discuss it, willing to compartmentalize our differences and realize that the work of the committee has to get done. So those kind of things do take place in Congress. It doesn't always capture the public attention, but there's a lot of work that goes on even between people that have had the most vehement disagreements.
I did want to finish with bipartisanship. How in the world do we start to heal our country? Would a Republican get something out of your book if they decide to pick it up?
Yes, they would. And I think what they would get out of it is the need to take back their party. The need for the Republican Party to be once again a party of ideas and ideology, a conservative party. It's not a conservative party right now. And I think many Republicans recognize that. It's why I think Liz Cheney speaks for a great many in her party. And I'd like to think that she's the future of that party. The question is, how far in the future is that future? I do think in terms of changing the tone, that's going to be nearly impossible as long as Donald Trump is the Republican standard bearer, because he gets up every morning determined to find new and different ways to divide us, to poison one American against another. You know, for crying out loud, on the eve of Colin Powell's death, he couldn't restrain himself from attacking Colin Powell. Someone like that should not be representing one of America's great parties. And we really need a two-party system, at least a two-party system, for this whole thing to work. So, yes, I think Republicans should read this book, and they should read it with an open mind. And more than that, they need to take their party back.